All right, welcome back to the Games Afoot, where gaming means business. This is KPC Radio, and I'm your host, George Brooks. You've tuned into the show where we feature people who've taken their love of gaming in varying forms and turned it into a profitable passion. So if your thing is video games, board games, games, this is your show. Today we're going to talk about tabletop games. Today's guest is Jonathan Jordan. He's the founder of Flintlock Game Studio. And we're going to discuss with him today just kind of the process of getting into tabletop gaming, where it began, you know, its origins, stuff like that, and how he personally moved into that line of business and how it's worked out for him over the past 15, 16 some odd years. So welcome to the show, Jonathan. Glad to have you here. So I guess to start off with, tell us a bit about yourself.
I mean, I'm an OG gamer most of my life, you know, born in 82. So my first console was an Atari family computer system that had slots for like the 2600 and like all the other cartridge types, you know, and then got my NES with some birthday money, you know. Played the Ninja Turtles arcade game every day.
Ninja Turtles, wow.
Yeah.
For me, it was Zelda. I was on Zelda all the time.
Yeah, man.
To the point of where my mother would make me get up and go outside.
Yeah, which is funny because that's the first time I went an entire night without sleep was when I bought my Nintendo 64 and Ocarina of Time. And I put that game in after dinner, like 9 o'clock, and I'm like, oh, I'm just gonna play for a little bit. And the next thing I know, my mom like opens the door and she's like, are you getting ready for school? Did you sleep last night? And I was like, oh yeah, I just woke up early to play the game because I like this. No, I didn't sleep at all. I slept in school that day.
Now the first game I can think of where I actually pulled an all-nighter was Metal Gear Solid.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one.
So
yeah, yeah. And then you know, in high school I got super into StarCraft and StarCraft Brood War, which, you know, kind of led into the more competitive gaming. I was pretty big in the Halo 2 competitive scene, made top 2000 in Xbox Live ladder for Halo 2. You know, literally quit my job to play Halo 2 for a little while.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. See, I was good with original Halo, because we actually used to have Halo parties.
Oh, yeah, same.
We'd get the Ethernet hub and connect them. We'd have set up in different rooms, and we'd just go at it. And I thought I was pretty good until I ran into guys who were serious about their Halo. And like this one guy, Jason Latona, that lived in Orlando, Florida. He was just merciless to the point of where we stopped inviting him to come over. But I mean, that community you form really good, in some cases lifelong friendships, because I don't know if you're familiar with the actor Scott Porter.
Yeah.
But he was part of our group when we all used to work at Universal or Disney, when we worked at the theme parks. We would get together and play. And even now, so many years late, like, what was that, 2000, 2001? So, like, even now, like, 16, 17 years later, he and I still talk. He, obviously, he's an actor. He's out here in California. And we bump into each other at the comic book shops. We still talk, you know, text message. We every once in a while he'll hit me with a Facebook message or I'll send him one.
Yeah.
You know, so like, yeah, I mean, it's interesting how the gaming community, you can form those kinds of bonds.
Absolutely.
It's almost replaced like the playground dynamic when you're a kid.
Yeah, 100%. No, and I mean, that's, you know, to your point, a lot of the guys from that guild, I mean, we started Halo 1 doing LAN parties and then made a guild in Halo 2 and Halo 3, and I'm still friends with them. You know, one of them actually, Tony, the guy whose house it was, he had a big house with a bunch of rooms, so we would bring over TVs. That way we had everybody, you know, everybody could fit in. He's the one that got me into Dungeons & Dragons. He's the one that really got me into tabletop games. So, you know, obviously we played a lot as a kid. Scrabble was kind of the game of the household, and my family was ruthless. Like, didn't matter that I was 6 years old. Like, my mom played to win, you know? I still remember the first time I beat my mom in Scrabble. Like, I still remember that.
Yeah, no, we didn't play Scrabble with my mom because my mother is very much the same way. And, yeah. and if she's not playing Scrabble, she's doing crossword puzzles. She's mm-hmm. just constantly on that.
Yeah.
Thing. So it's like, you know, you never played with mom because mom was like, oh, I got, you know, a Q, a Z, an X, and a J. Hold on. I could use them all.
What do you mean?
Go get the dictionary. Is that really a word?
Yeah.
I've never seen a word with a Q and a J in it. Like,
and magically, it is a word.
Exactly.
It's mom. Yeah. I know that all too well. Yeah. So Tony, one day was like, man, have you guys ever played Dungeons & Dragons? And I was like, not since I was a kid, you know. And he's like, all right, we're going to play. Like, let's do Thursday nights. You know, we locked in. We got a group together. And I was like, this is amazing. Like, we did that. We did, Mech Warrior and a few other things and just kind of started getting really into tabletop gaming from there. And that kind of ignited my passion. So I started running and doing, you know, DM stuff and running my own campaigns. And then when 4th edition came out, I was in the process of moving out here and I wanted to do my own campaign to meet people, you know. I knew a couple people that were out here, but I'm like, what better way to meet people, build friendships than to start a D&D campaign? Because you're, you know, essentially locking yourself in for at least a year, you know.
Yeah.
Probably multiple.
Unless you're just a jerk DM who, like, kills off people's favorite characters.
Right, yeah.
Never play
yeah.
with you again. I had that character since the 7th grade.
Yeah, and that was what I was originally familiar with from D&D, because back when we were kids, like, that was what it was. It was the DM versus the players.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of going away a little bit in 3.5, but not really. Man, Tony was a ruthless dungeon master. I remember... you know, one of the guys, the barbarian, like, ran into these goblins. It was like a cave entrance, and I was a ranger, so I was sticking back in the trees, kind of firing arrows, and everything seemed to kind of settle. And he's like, all right, you see movement in the brush down on the left. I'm like, all right, I shoot at it, and I roll, and I miss. And he says to my friend Randy, who's the barbarian, he's like, an arrow flies right by your head. Like, what kind of a DM are you?
Like, what kind of a ranger are you that you miss like that?
Well, and then, you know, he's just like, oh, you see movement. And I immediately shot, but it was my friend. But I was too far away to tell what was what. He was a really ruthless.
So it was actually a good thing that you rolled and missed, because
exactly.
otherwise you might have killed your member of your team.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. But it just, like, that was one of those moments that I was like, this is such a great story. Like, that's really what I feel like tabletop gaming really brings, and gaming in general, is great stories. You know, being able to kind of come together and then have this amazing experience to talk with people afterwards. And so I wanted to craft a little more of that. And you know, it started with one of my favorite modules, the Sunless Citadel. And they hadn't, like, 4th edition had just come out, and I was like, we're going to start there. That was where I started with Tony. That was the first one he ran us through. So there's some nostalgia to it, but it's a legendary adventure. It's super great. It's a really great place to start. And, you know, I started converting that to 4th edition, and then I was like, you know, this story can continue. So I started kind of adding my own elements, and then I just wound up writing my own campaign as we played it. And I'd spend, you know, 5 to 10 hours a week prepping each week for the game session. And that campaign ran for 3.5 years, and we didn't get to finish.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That's a long time to not finish, too. That's...
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, and it's funny how you say, like, you know, gaming, the core, the essential ingredient to gaming is story.
Yeah.
And that's why people get so into these games. And it doesn't seem to translate to film well. That's
right.
That's one of the things that really irritates me, because film is my thing. That's actually what I'm going to school for. And I see the Resident Evil movies and the Silent Hill movies mm-hmm. and, you know, just...
Assassin's Creed.
Yeah, and it just seems like nobody, even the new Tomb Raider that came out, it's still just, it doesn't seem like they get it quite right. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's because they're not having actual avid gamers write the screenplays. Mm. If it was, if you, because that's kind of the formula that Marvel eventually started doing, was having people who enjoyed the format, enjoyed the characters, grew up with those characters, start making those movies.
Yeah.
It wasn't just, hey, let's do a comic book movie. It was, let's find somebody who really, really loves Spider-Man or really, really loves Batman and you know, hand, and is it the Batman thing worked with Christopher Nolan because he was a huge fan. Yep. And the Marvel Studios movies, as they've gone, have just been rolling in money because they care about story and structure and having everything connect and bring, immersing the audience into that world. And I would just love to see somebody do that with a movie based on a game.
Yeah.
There was a discussion on Twitter yesterday with Stephen DeKnight. He's the director of the new Pacific Rim Uprising movie. He had also done the Spartacus TV show.
Yeah.
He was the showrunner for the first season of Daredevil. And somebody asked him, as a fan of video games, what games he would like to see made into movies.
Yeah.
And he said God of War was a big one.
Oh, yeah.
He wants to see Guillermo del Toro do a BioShock movie. And I thought, that's an amazing idea.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, the potential is there. Like you said, story is there. It's just a matter of getting it in the right hands. And so... You know, for our listeners, those people that love gaming and love gaming for those stories, it's pretty much the same thing. Like, people get into film because they look at films and they go, I can do that better.
Yeah.
And I'm imagining that, you know, gaming, whether it's video gaming, tabletop games, what have you, that's the same thing, as where you play a game, you really enjoy it, but you're like, what can I do with this formula that is working so well for me, but improve upon it?
Yeah.
So it's like, how long does it normally take to create a game from like concept to finished product? Like, how long does it normally take you?
Oh man, that really depends on the game, you know? I mean, a smaller game in theory would take less time. But, you know, it depends on what you're kind of building off of, right? Because, I mean, most of us in high school made some kind of variation of Uno or, you know, something with regular playing cards.
House that rules. Took us,
right, exactly. Yeah. You know, and really, I mean, that's the bare bones, like the most boilerplate game creation. You know, you're taking existing cards or you're taking a set of cards or something and building some rules or some additional mechanics around it, even if it's just, you know, making up new rules for Uno or trying to create another. Like, we... I worked a couple summers at this Christian youth camp in high school, and Magic the Gathering was obviously banned, right? And one of the kids was super obsessed with it and didn't think he could go the whole summer working there without playing it. So we created, with Uno cards, a recreation of Magic the Gathering.
Wow.
And just boilerplated, and each color was a mana type, and these cards were mana, these cards were attack, these cards were defense, like, and you know, and that's what we played, right? And I mean, you know, a lot of people that are super into games have done something similar, and you're already essentially creating games, right? So on that core level, yeah, you could do it in, you know, 20 minutes or so, but really, if we're talking about something that you're going to be making and selling, I mean, a long time. Like, and the reason why is, even if you're building off of existing mechanics, even if you have a very clear sense of the story, there's going to be a lot of time spent on aesthetic design. I mean, the UI and UX are terms that you hear a lot in startups and the app development world and the design world, but I mean, those are huge, huge aspects of gaming. Any great game, like a game that has, you know, card elements to it, right? Like cards. I should be able to look at the card and get a general sense of what I can do with that card in that game without having to read the rule book. And if I can't, then that card was designed poorly, right? So there's a lot of time that goes into the actual UI and UX design of the game. And then, you know, you're doing a ton of playtesting, and that's what's going to take a lot of time as well. As I mean, I could sit down, I could make a game, and I could think it's great, and I could test it just on my own and look at all the math of the mechanics and be like, yeah, this is a good game. And then I go to put it out in the wild, and suddenly everyone else finds every mistake and all the things I didn't consider and take into mind. So you have to do, you know, live play tests a ton, and once you get all the notes you feel you can get from there, you know, I mean, you really rely on the board game community, honestly, for board games specifically, is you're going to be sending out blind play tests where you just send a copy of the game, a copy of the rules, and a survey, and then they send you back the survey. So you are not there at all to clarify rules. So you have to know whether or not your written rules
You have to make sure the rules are clear so that they're able to play the game and enjoy the game without you standing there explaining everything. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, my my friend Len has kickstarted a couple games successfully, and he has one, Devil's Advocate, which is a very simple, party game. Basically, where one person reads a statement and then everybody else votes on whether they would agree or disagree, and then they tell everyone whether they do, and you score points. Very simple, you know, game mechanics. I'd say, you know, development time for him was probably 6 months at least for that. And you think, you know, mechanics wise, it's a very simple game. Yeah, but the point system, you know, the fun element, all those things have to be worked through and tested. Significantly. So, I mean, I have game concepts that I've been working on for 2 to 3 years, and I've put them into alpha testing a couple times and pulled them back.
Because they didn't work, or maybe you weren't getting the type of feedback you were looking
for.
So
one of them I pulled back after alpha testing, because once we put it in the hands of people that weren't familiar with the mechanics of it, they broke it very easily. just the balance just wasn't really there. And then another one, like, the mechanics were great and it just wasn't fun. The fun element wasn't there. And I mean, and that's, you know, a good tabletop game has an element of theme or story that people can buy into. It has social element, right? Because, I mean, otherwise, why are you coming around the table if you're not going to be social, right? And it has to be fun, but all the mechanics also have to work together. And real fun comes from proper balance. Like, that's why, you know, we were talking before we went on air about Monopoly. Part of why I don't think it's a fun game is because it wasn't, I mean, obviously it wasn't designed to be fun, but there's no real balance to the mechanics. Once one person gets ahead, they're probably going to win, and everybody else is just miserable until that actually happens.
It's very difficult to catch up in Monopoly.
Right. Yeah, there's no regard for balance in the rules of Monopoly at all. Whereas Risk is a very balanced game. Now, granted, you know, starting in Australia is going to give you certain, you know, advantages or disadvantages, things like that. But, you know, if we're talking classic games, those are there. You know, a game like Carcassonne, which in my opinion has probably some of the most elegant rules of any board game. It's a lot like Go or chess or Othello, and where it's one of those that the mechanics are very simple. You draw a tile, you play a tile anywhere where the sides line up with the other tiles on the table, and you can place a worker if you want. That's it. You can teach it in like 2 minutes. But to actually master it, to actually be good at it, requires a lot. And getting there, I mean, I'd imagine Carcassonne was probably in development for a couple of years before it was put to market.
See, those are the type of games that I enjoy, though. The ones that, you know, take a couple minutes to learn, but possibly a lifetime to master. Like, my father taught me how to play chess in an afternoon. But once you memorize how the pieces are supposed to move, it's still up to you to decide a strategy.
Right.
And you have to be able to adapt based on the level of the person you're playing against. You know, sometimes I'll play against a person and I can have them in checkmate in 9 moves.
Right. Yeah.
And then other times the game will go on for hours because, you know, I'm sitting there formulating a plan and a guy across the table from me has already figured out like 7 moves ahead based on what I'm going to do. And I was like, oh, makes my head hurt sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's the thing, like, you have to look at the board and go, okay, well, if I move here, he can do this. If I move there, he can do it. What is the move that I have available to me that where he has the least counter moves available?
Right.
And like I said, you can learn this piece moves forward one place. This piece moves diagonally. This place moves in an L shape. But it's still up to you to formulate the strategy. And you can either be really good or really terrible, depending on who you're playing against.
Right.
So, yeah. like you mentioned Othello. Mm-hmm. Oh, God, how much did I love that game?
Yeah.
Just, I would sit and play that game with my dad or with my sister and, you know, just flipping over. Gotcha. Yeah. Like, that whole role is mine.
Yeah.
So, do you manufacture the games yourself?
No.
Or do
So pre-alpha testing, yeah. Like, when I'm actually going through the mechanics, you know, the early stages of a game design, you're always going to start with one thing. It's either the mechanics or the concept. You know, either there's a mechanic that I'm like, man, I love that mechanic. I need to put that in something. Mm-hmm. You know, I need to use some variance of this mechanic in something because I really love it, right? Or you're like, man, I just really want to make a zombie game, you know, which was everybody's thought like 7 years ago, uh-huh. You know?
And still kind of is on level.
Yeah.
It's just still the zombie thing has not... The vampire thing finally went away after a while, but the mm-hmm. zombie thing is holding on strong.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, like, so you're always going to start with one of the two. And then from there, it's a lot of just, honestly, pencil on paper, you know, or Apple Pencil on iPad for me. Just, you know, like literally just writing out and figuring things out. And then there's a lot of math involved. If you are wanting to get into game design and you hate math, you might want to reconsider. And, you know, maybe you'll want to get into like the design elements of like the UI, the UX, the art design, animation, if you want to get into video games. But if you want to get into like the actual coding of video games or the actual mechanics of gameplay, that's a lot of algebra. It's a lot of math. You're working in probabilities a ton. You know, because, I mean, that's really what it's about. How many cards do we need in a deck in order to get the proper balance in gameplay, right? Stuff like that. How many times are a win result going to come up in a die roll? I'm working on a tabletop system right now, a mechanic system, and I'd say probably 2 weeks was just spent with dice and number of dice and how many sided dice it was going to be, like, you know, just to get the probabilities right so that it was fun but challenging, right? Everything should follow kind of the rule of cool. But so once you get through that, then I usually will do a super quick and dirty design in Photoshop, or sometimes I'll even buy a deck of blank cards if it's a card game and just use markers on there. But one way or the other, you kind of mock up a really quick and dirty paper-based playtest with whatever you can get. You can literally just print them out on paper, cut them out, whatever, you know. And then you start testing that way with close friends. And once you feel like you've got it to where the mechanics are flowing, then I work with, there's a website called The Game Crafter.
Okay.
And you can do one-off prints of stuff. You can also get blank cards and do things on your own. And they work with, you know, manufacturers in China. So you get really good prices even on one-off prints.
Okay. See, that was going to be my question, is like, once you've actually got the game set, like, how do you mass produce it?
Exactly. So GameCrafter does mass production as well. The guys that created Cards Against Humanity actually have a company called Black Box, and it's specifically for people that are trying to do what they did. They started on Kickstarter. And, you know, I was actually one of the original Kickstarter backers because my friend just worked with Ben Hantoot from there, and so I heard about it back then and followed them since. But, I mean, there were... I want to say like 47 people total that backed on Kickstarter, or maybe 147. It was not huge on Kickstarter. It was afterwards when it got in people's hands and people
word of mouth
play and
began
word of
to
mouth.
Spread.
Yeah. And so they originally had to do their distribution through Amazon. Like, they had to essentially mass produce and then do fulfill by Amazon and have everything held at the Amazon warehouses. And they weren't getting really great, you know, profit margins on that. So they started working directly with manufacturers and with distribution warehouses. And so that now they have a network of manufacturers and distributors for people that want to kickstart ideas so that they can have really low overhead on that and make as much profit as possible off of the Kickstarter. So.
Okay. All right. So now time for the shameless self-promotion plug. Someone who's listened to the show is interested in checking out one of your games. Where can they go to find your stuff?
I mean, pretty much right now, our Facebook page. So all of our stuff that we're putting out right now is free to play. So it's just print and play. You know, just kind of going on, you print it out yourself, play it. We're focusing right now on actually releasing modules for Savage Worlds and some other tabletop-based games, you know, where people can just kind of print them, play them. If they like them, donate to us. That kind of thing. They just get a free PDF, you know, and follow the rules there. And then, you know, yeah, so we're Flintlock Games Studio on Facebook. We're moving into the digital world. I've been dragging my feet on that. So we'll be on, you know, we'll be on Twitter and Instagram as well. And then we'll be, you know, dropping our first game on Kickstarter either this year or the beginning of next year. But yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming. It's been a blast talking to you, and I've learned a lot about tabletop gaming. And like I said, yeah, thanks for coming, man. I really appreciate you coming here. I'm a little sad that, you know, your partner couldn't make it, but hopefully everything's going okay, and the situation will work itself out.
Yeah.
So this has been George Brooks for The Games Afoot, where gaming means business. This is KPC Radio. Thank you for listening, and we'll have you tune in next time. Thanks a lot. Bye.